Welcome, everybody, to the Reflex Blue Show. We are coming back again to you from the, is it the Heinz Convention Center?
Something
here in
like
Boston, Massachusetts. We have with us my co-host, Ben Luters.
Hello, everybody.
Donovan Beery, and we have brought in Ricardo Crespo. Ricardo, how are you doing this morning?
Good, good, guys. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, and what is it in particular that you're speaking about here while we're at the conference?
The HOW Conference folks have very kindly invited me back to reprise a subject under many different titles or descriptions, but it's basically this notion of bridging a gap from how people and brands and organizations are perceived to how they need to be in reality, in actuality. So that perception to reality gap and all the different things that happen in between, whether that's an individual and how they're perceived to how they're seen credible. To organizations that suffer from the same thing. So little triggers, little attributes to look out for, and little tips and techniques to help them bridge that gap, overcome it.
Is this a topic that you originally proposed to them, or is it something that somebody came to you and asked if you wanted to talk about it?
It was something that I didn't actually propose it to the HOW folks, but it's something that is very near and dear to me because it's something that's been very innate in sort of my career path. And it actually came to fruition because of a very fortunate, overwhelming response to be able to go, geez, kid, you need to tell that story to a lot more people where they can hear it. And a good friend of mine, Todd Henry, sat down and said, listen, I know, Rick, that you don't want to write a book, but in lieu of a book, why don't you maybe just share the story with people? And the first time I shared it was just a small group of 20 people, very intimate business leaders. And then that business leader said, can you come to my organization and tell me a little bit about that so that you can tell my creative team? And it just blew up from there. And, you know, it's amazing because it strikes a chord with a lot of people. It's something that resonates very deeply with them, but they haven't, many different people articulate it many different ways. So just the opportunity to be able to share it with our community here and the HOW Conference is a really wonderful way to do that.
And for our listeners, Ricardo worked at Mattel for 10 years, is that right?
2010.
And now is creative director? Is that the right term? What's your exact position?
Oh my God, it's a silly title, but
they always are.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? The official designation is Senior Vice President and Global Creative Chief.
At Fox,
20th Century Fox in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Well, it's entertainment, so they want to have you give you an entertaining title.
Yeah, and it's a compensation for my shortness.
Oh, you know? Well, there you go.
Ricardo, it all balances out.
Ricardo was trying to impress us at the bar last night and was telling us that he works at Fox Plaza. Is that right?
Fox Plaza, correct.
And you may recognize this building from Die Hard.
The original Die Hard movie. The Nakatomi Plaza.
Did they rebuild the roof after that movie? They blew it up. They blew it up for the movie, right?
Oh, no. It's still the same place.
Yeah. No, I mean, didn't they?
How they air conditioned the building. There's
okay,
no roof.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that was how that worked.
Very nice.
It's surreal, though, because, you know, the funny story there is most of the people that we have the wonderful fortune to come and visit and say hi to us, they inadvertently show up at the building, and they have that two-second pause where they're going, oh, man, this looks familiar. What is it? And then you sort of drop the bomb on them. They're like, no way, dude.
That's what Steve Gordon was saying last night. It just took him a couple of seconds. It's like, crap, I've seen this before, but I don't know where I've seen this. So,
yeah.
Very good. Now, Donovan and I are big toy buffs, so we need to talk to you about Mattel. We'd love to hear what are some of the things that came across your desk. What's your favorite projects? What were some of the weirdest ones? Just anything you have about that 10-year
Yeah, well,
time.
Listen, Mattel is such a wonderful place. I would literally go back there in a minute because it's such a wonderful culture. It's a breeding ground for just true innovation and creativity. But there's also many other things that really drive me right now. So, you know, being at Fox is another. But there's a quintessential creative is where's the most challenging personal space that I can be. And Fox is that right wonderful place right now. But, yeah, Mattel is this wonderful place. Don't regret any minute that I had there. But it's awesome. I mean, how could you not love that gig? You're working with, you know, I'd even transcend it going, I don't want to describe it as the product, which was the toys. You're working with how to influence putting smiles on people's faces, whether that was a little boy, a little girl, a collector, a car buff for Hot Wheels, you know, the young girl who's just very much into the whole idea of American Girl. Mattel's a big company. It owns a lot of really global, equitable brands, but, you know, probably the of all the many different things I had the wonderful good fortune to work on, a couple of things was probably the most memorable was working on the Disney business, being able to work with Mr. Lasseter and the team over at Pixar for all those Toy Story franchises and things like that.
There's an instant design cred just went way up.
Yeah, fun stuff. And then probably the other one that really comes to mind was just the whole iterative process of being invited to work with Jim Cameron and John Landau on Avatar. Mattel was the master toy licensee for that movie, so getting into the inner sanctum 2 years before the movie had even started filming per se, and understanding that we had a chance to influence working with then 20th Century Fox, I was not with them, but to understand what it is that Mattel was able to contribute. So in that space, I had the wonderful fortune to help design the identity around what Avatar looked like as a package, as a feeling that tied into how people would eventually see it as the movie.
And you were saying last night that it was through that you ended up landing the gig you have now at 20th Century?
Yeah, one of the many attributes. I mean, the 20th Century gig was also attributed to many other factors that my previous experiences had allowed me to get on their radar, if you will, that resulted in the invitation. But, you know, prior to joining Mattel, I come from the advertising agency world. I'm a formerly trained graphic designer, but...
I want to talk about that more in a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask, let's go back to Avatar.
Sure.
When you said you started working on this, like, 2 years in advance, how much, like, input does a toy company like that, how much direct involvement do you have with the movie itself? Was the movie even completed, or... What do you guys, what is the hardest, is there any difficulties in working with something that's not even done? Well, and isn't going to be for 2 years?
Well, we are granted certain amount of information, as you can imagine, that's proprietary. But we're sort of, you know, for a need-to-know basis, because even some of the folks within Fox, because of its big, at that time, you got to imagine, it was such a groundbreaking new project with the whole idea that Jim Cameron was creating his own equipment to be able to tell a story of this magnitude. So.
Sure.
Our involvement was to be able to contribute as experts in the space of toys and in the space of packaging of those toys, you know, because the partnership that was intriguing for Fox, of which they worked with Mattel and then through Lightstorm, which is the producers, the makers of the movie, was that how do we make sure that once this movie releases and airs, that there is a way for people to effectively find and connect with it immediately, directly on the shelf at the Toys R Us, the Targets of the world. And so it was our expertise that we were able to consult with them and say, geez, if this is what this character is going to be like and this is what this environment's going to be like, we can translate that this way and we can help tell your story through the package. We can help tell your story through the way that we will have the figures articulate and things like that. So the one-on-ones of sort of the toy business, but it was really, my particular group was able to influence how, you know, the package was the effective billboard on how people got into the story of Avatar outside of the movie. You know, we always treated it as if our MO and our creative group was, we have to assume that no one saw the movie. We have to assume that they're only aware of the movie because there's the buzz around it. There's this, you know, this the world called Pandora. And
sure.
How did we effectively use our package as the gateway to do that? And then if they did see the movie, then we have to deliver on that promise to go, I'm familiar with the movie, but now how does this extend that story? So we were shared limited information, but that's the beauty of creativity, is that you have to take that limited information and exploit it to its fullest potential. And I think that was the success of the story, was they understood that given the proprietary limited information that we were shared, that we were able to see beyond that and help them tell their story through our product lines and what Mattel did best.
No, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break, and we're going to be right back with Ricardo Crespo. Okay, Ricardo, I want to ask you, when it comes to, like, toys and stuff, what is like, the one toy that you had when you were a kid that got you into that love? What was it that brought the smile to your face?
I hate to say it, but it was Hot Wheels. But it was the Hot Wheels because I wasn't so much doing what the regular perception was, which is jumping and stunting and making the cars fly. I think this will probably resonate. I was destroying the cars, stomping on them and crashing them and trying to put firecrackers underneath them. But You know, it was also a different way that Hot Wheels, like with most boys, it was that's the connection where you first draw to going. It's that quintessential, you know, the age old, why do girls gravitate to dolls and why do boys gravitate to vehicles? It was textbook. It was that I went very quickly from push around imaginative play that I'm the race car driver to going, geez, what if I'm a big old monster stomping on this because I can't make through? You know, it was that idea that, you know, fortuitously, many years later, being part of the organization, you never forget those days, and you can help relive that. So it was wonderful. Now having kids of my own, you can really see how they are going through that same cycle.
Now do you allow your kids with the Hot Wheels, or are they all on the cars with the Pixar? Because
both.
Okay.
Both.
They're allowed to have both.
Yeah. Well, because they're, you know, cars. The other way that cars are anthropomorphic, so they're in a story within their own, which is, you know, Mater and Lightning McQueen and the whole idea of Radiator Town. But Hot Wheels are really evocative and representative of more that true fantastical play, that you can be anything that you want. There's a specific finite way that you play within the car's world, which is amazing and immersive, but Hot Wheels is truly anything that you can and want to be.
You know, I was not much of a Hot Wheels guy. I didn't have a whole lot of cars, but my younger brother, I have an 11-year-old brother, who next door neighbor was moving and gave him a Hot Wheels racetrack, the kind that, you know, the little motors on them and it goes around, from 1969, I believe.
Wow.
So this is old, but everything still works. It even has like the little gauges that can tell how fast they're going and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And they gave him a whole bunch of cars, and he's in heaven. As soon as I came over the other day, he just like had to show me everything. We hooked it up. We built like four different, you know. So I was like, this is actually kind of cool. I feel like I missed out on something, you know, from my childhood.
Yeah. No, Hot Wheels is great because it really is a piece of Americana. You can't, you know, it's an actual known statistic, but you can't go 10 feet and nobody not know Hot Wheels and what it represents, you know, and that's globally, mm-hmm. which is pretty amazing. But the Hot Wheels thing was just many of the wonderful chapters. I got to work with some really cool action figure lines. Like we had a brand called Max Steel that was very popular in Latin America. But probably the other single most fun opportunity I had was working on He-Man, Masters of the Universe, which was really, really cool to be able to work with that and understand the legacy of what it represented and being able to replicate those figures in there.
What I want to know
Well, first off, what is the best He-Man figure?
Oh, everyone will give you, but personally?
Yeah, I mean, everyone's got a different one.
Skeletor.
I was
going to
say, you got to say Skeletor.
You cannot have a name like Skeletor and be a freaking badass. Like, seriously. You're like that. Talk about being able to go, I walk in a room and my name's Skeletor, you got to step up.
Yeah.
Like, go big or go home, because you have a name like that. You got to deliver.
Yeah, and you got a skull for a head. I mean, you can't do anything but be like an evil mastermind.
Well, anyone who owns a cape, you got to be a badass.
That's hilarious. The question I had was, how much actually designing of the toys did you do, and how much of just like management and kind of, you know, big picture stuff? I just want to know, trying to get a feel for what your job looked like.
As the chief creator would tell you, it was really fun because, although I'm not a formally trained industrial designer, toy designer per se, one of the great things about the cross-function disciplines was sort of as a creative leader, one of the great ways that we worked there as a culture was that as a creative leader, even though I wasn't a toy designer, I could speak the toy design language and I could articulate to the team what it is that we need to achieve, and it would be their expertise and our vision and our expertise coming together to do that. But it was great because they also taught me an immense amount about just the business of play, if you will. Not toy design, but just the business of experience and play on how you take something from a concept to a tissue sheet to be able to craft your first proto and you SLA it, which is like the wax mold, to be able to go, how do you prove this form factor out? What does it look like from the back, to 3D modeling, to then traveling on a plane, going to China and seeing it come off as a first prototype and paint ops and specs and,
wow.
You know, so it was fully immersive, but it's also, the other part was being able to understand, more importantly, when we did what we did, it's because what the fans wanted us to do. And that's one thing I will give Mattel very much credit for, is it's very easy for a big company like that to just say, we're a big company, we're going to do it because we can and we want to. They were really true, and that's what makes them successful, is they understand who the fans are, mm-hmm. what they want, and so that when you show up at a place like Comic-Con with a new fig or a retro fig of you know, Skeletor and He-Man, that there's... It makes a lot of sense. And whether it was He-Man, Skeletor, or we would license and do business with the superhero, the Warner Brothers of the world, and DC Comics, it was always on point, and it was exactly what people wanted. So it was really good that way.
I got a full shelf of Superman figures above my desk. So which ones do you guys do? Because they do a lot of the DC Direct ones that go straight to the comic shop. Does Mattel run all of those too, or is that a sub-brand? Or?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay, yeah. I just didn't know. Well, what was the one, I mean, because for me, that's like the coolest action figure there is, you know, Superman figures right now. But what is like the one toy that, was there any toy where you're like, I really wish Mattel owned that, because that would be what I would, you know, that's, there's got to be something
that you
That
was
wanted.
A non-Mattel toy?
Yeah, like was there the one toy where you'd go to a store and you're like, why can't we work on that too, you know?
No, because, you know, honestly, I'm not at Mattel anymore, but I would argue that, no, not really, because everyone wanted to be Mattel.
Okay.
There's a reason they're number one. And not because they're arrogant and big, it's because they're smart. They're a smart company. You know, there's always going to be the space for the other players, like the Hasbros and the world, all wonderful people. But it's not like Mattel ever said, geez, could we do it better if we had, quote-unquote, Transformers? Each company celebrates its own uniqueness, their own expertise. And I think what I'd encourage us to do is not look at it as to go, who owns what and why we do it, but like, how are we making sure that the fans are liking what they want? Because the way that I'll answer your question is, if you look at it from a fan's perspective, the fans don't understand Mattel or Hasbro. They understand the characters, the figures, the storylines, right? And so it's not so much that as a company you're going, I wish we had that, or I wish we did that. I think we all hold hands as an industry and we go, that's great that we're doing this. Because at the end of the day, the truth of the matter is, my son isn't technically loyal to Mattel. He's loyal to what he wants to do and play. And if one day he wants to play with Lego or Transformers or Hot Wheels, he has that. And we should give him that flexibility to do that. The thing is that you'd ideally want him to play with the stuff that you influence and you make. But that's actually a funny thing. That was a rule that my wife and I ever first agreed upon joining Mattel, was we would never bring home toys for the boys.
Really?
Yeah.
Why did you make that decision?
We wanted to make sure that I asked her for her help, and I said, listen, it's very easy to be able to just, you know, take something from daddy's office and come home. But what we wanted to do was not lose the value of what we did. And we wanted they were like my little focus group. I wanted to see what they wanted. You know, and 90% of the time it's stuff that Mattel made, which is why I said they didn't really see labels or brands. They saw stuff that they wanted to do. They saw experience of play. But it was also good to see why they would choose other properties, other brands, other products, to look at me and go, what is it about that that's drawing him? What is it about that's drawing his friend to it? That kind of stuff. So, I don't know if that answered your question.
All in the family. I like it.
Yeah, it actually did. And toys are one of those things where every now and then they can kind of come together. And, you know, He-Man can all of a sudden, like, battle Superman.
But and He-Man can go date Barbie. What the hell? Sure.
Yeah,
of course. She's already in a loincloth.
She's a little
he's
tall.
He's halfway there.
She's tall for him, but he's man. He can handle it.
Not. He's He-Man.
Ricardo, as I was looking at one of your bios, I saw that you worked at Bozell Worldwide. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Bozell is actually in Omaha. What's left? Well, I mean, they bought themselves back.
Well, it started out there, and then it went global, and now it's...
That was a while ago, but Bozell, it was actually under the big agency conglomerate, which is BCP, which was fun. But I worked on some chocolate business at that account.
Business.
Yeah, it was awesome.
All you've ever done is fun. What is wrong with you?
I don't know, James.
Chocolate,
you know,
toys,
you choose to work on fun.
Fox.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Well, we actually had Bozell on the show just recently because they were on that the TV show. The Pants.
Okay.
And so I was just wondering, did you ever like?
Oh, I saw that episode. That was really cool. They went to New York and they mm-hmm. were against a small agency in California.
Yep,
right.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
And
yeah.
Well, Bozell. I mean, in Omaha, they're a big agency, but right now I think they're like 35 people. So
right.
So they're not the eighth largest in the world. But when you were there, did you ever like? What office were you in? Because they had like 50 offices.
Oh, in the Toronto office.
Okay.
Yeah, so my ad agency tenure was living in Toronto. I grew up in Toronto, up in
That's
Canada.
Right. You're from Canada.
Yeah.
Speaking of ad agencies, how was your transition from the ad agency side to the client side? Was that quite a transition? Or
you know, at first it was, but what drew me to the client side, if you will, was that, you know, the quintessential, the best way I'll describe it is when you're the agency is sort of what we do in a creative business. You're ultimately, whether we realize it or not, are still very much stereotyped and bucketed under the service industry moniker. And because you're in the service industry, good, bad, or indifferent, it is what it is. It is just that. There's this predisposition that do this, and here's what I'm paying you for, so service my account and do this. And the challenge there was being on that side, I always felt like I was delivering against what our client at that point, and whatever agency it was, we were delivering really well against them. But the challenge was, sometimes if the client, most of the time, if the client didn't articulate their vision or their needs effectively, and we felt we executed against the brief that was given to us, you can only draw so much out of your client. Most of the time, it would ultimately be reviewed, the creative would be reviewed subjectively. And that was the biggest killer of engagement for us, of energy and stuff. It was like, this is our really best work because here's what you've tasked us to do, and here's where we understand where it can go. And is the proverbial, I don't like blue. Why'd you do blue? And like, really? You're talking about blue when you're not talking about what we've achieved and what you wanted to achieve.
We're doing blue because James Cameron told us to do blue.
They're all blue.
but the jump to the agency side was sort of my opportunity to say, okay, if I'm going to be the creative on sort of this side of the fence, how am I effectively still being that creative, but just now having the autonomy on this side so that when I engage those people that used to be my colleagues, who still are my colleagues, that I'm articulating to them and saying, here's what we know how to do best, here's what I need your help to do, and how do we meet in the middle? Mm-hmm. So it was sort of my drive to go client side to be able to go, geez, how do I start a movement, whether it's just me or start to influence this idea that as a creative on that side of the fence, proverbial fence, that we haven't lost sight of the value of what creative thinking does to the bigger picture. God, that sounded like a marketing thing, didn't it? But
it sounds like you're trying to get back into Bozell. All right, now, Ricardo, you're now at 20th Century Fox, and when I think of Fox, I think of being in, oh man, I was maybe in junior high, and my cousins came back to visit us because they live down in the Valley area or something in Pleasanton.
Okay.
And they brought back these VHS tapes of.
Oh my God, VHS.
Yeah.
Wow. And wait, what's that again?
Exactly.
They had episodes of the Tracy Ullman Show, end of The Simpsons, end of Married with Children, and they were on there. And they left them with us, you know, like 6 hours on like three tapes, and we watched those shows like on a loop. I mean, we wore those tapes out. So a couple years
later, that's awesome.
Yeah, a couple years later, it's probably season three of The Simpsons, and it's on, and been a huge Simpsons fan ever since. You know, I mean, just never left. And in fact, we even have our dog. I think when we met a few years ago, I told you I was going to mail my dog to you because his name's Homer. I was going to see if you could get Matt Groening to sign, but Homer J does not really like to be put in boxes and shipped, I found out.
Correct.
So my dog never quite made it to you. I'm sorry about that. But one day maybe I'll bring, you know, I'll find another way to get him out there to get him signed or something.
Or bring him out by hand.
Yeah.
Come visit us.
Well, you know, it works really well because he's a fawn pug, so he's got that yellowish skin, a little bit fat. He's got the constant 5 o'clock shadow, kind of lazy, and really he's
a. Does he grunt though?
He grunts. Yeah, he does a little snorting. He's really smart, which is you know, I mean, Homer in the show isn't as smart, but our dog also is a little self-centered too, so it kind of works out.
Does he like donuts?
We try to keep him away from the donuts. He's pugs. You should keep away from all grains, so the wheat and the donuts and stuff.
Got it.
Yeah, but you can feed him a ton of sprinkles. Pink icing and sprinkles. He's set for life.
Yeah, that's. I will.
That's a great idea. Maybe we should make dog collars that are about pink dog collars with icing sprinkles.
Did you guys did and then we actually went. I guess you weren't there, but yeah, I loved when the Simpsons movie came out and they did all the marketing and the 7-Elevens. We actually
turned on 7-Elevens to Quickie Marts.
Yeah, we actually went. We were by chance in Seattle when that happened, so I was able to go there. I think we stopped by there like three times so that I could keep bringing back Buzz Colas and stuff because we don't even have 7-Elevens in Omaha.
Yeah.
That's blasphemy. That is just not right.
We do have 1119s though, so that's good.
So what is it? What is it like to work on a brand like The Simpsons that goes back like 25 years? And I mean, to me, it's got to be a huge thing, not just in the U.S., but I mean, it's what you see those clips and they're in Spanish and
it's absolutely global. And our fan base for the show, it truly is global. The movie was a milestone. It was before I arrived at Fox, but it was so influential that it continues to drive and feeds the machine of why Simpsons resonates with everyone around the world. You know, it's amazing that, you know, Springfield is any town USA, and most recently Matt had, you know, basically shared that it was evocative of his hometown. But what's great about when it started way back in the day, and the shorts on the Tracy Ullman show, it was that amazing story that people resonate with, which is, you know, Homer's the sort of doofus but very loving father. The paradigm that happens between father and son, father and wife, and then all the dysfunctional friends around him, you know, like the neighbors, the Neds, the Cobbies. It's what everybody can relate to it at any given level. And what's great about it is it transcends that language. So it's real, it's humor, but it's just manifests itself not as a live action show, which is what's great about it. It's sort of fictional, but it kind of isn't, because that's how people can relate to it. You know, that's what's great about it. It's a huge brand to work on. It's daunting because of its legendary status, but you don't dwell on the daunting. You dwell on the fact that you're privileged to be able to be a part of where it can go, and your contributions, however small or big, helps it to continue to grow. We're really excited. We're actually about to head into our 25th anniversary in 2014. Which is another huge milestone, and we are going to go big as a studio with this.
No, I
needless
love
to say.
I remember when it went huge the first time, and there were shirts everywhere, and then all of a sudden, like, everything disappeared after like season 3 or 4 because they're like, don't overkill it.
Yeah.
And then when season 10 came and they started launching the action figure lines, and then all of a sudden they're like, I think the things I was say. Reading, the things I was reading around, where they're like, well, if it's not dead now, let's just run, you know, whatever. And one of my favorite lines is always, you know, Bart Simpson when Cosby went out, the Cosby show, and you know, he's watching the clip, and he's like, Dad, why is Cosby leaving there? And he's like, well, he wanted to leave before the quality went down. He's like, if I ever show, I'm going to run it to the ground.
The writing on it is really smart, as obviously you can tell. You know, that's what makes it successful.
Do you guys get to work a lot with the writers for the different shows when you do stuff like that?
In different capacities, yeah. But, you know, as you can imagine, The Simpsons as a brand, but even as a machine, has many cogs in that machine that make it run so smoothly. So there are defined roles and responsibilities, but what brings everyone together is where. Why is Simpsons still so relevant? What is it that each contributing party, whatever functional group they're in, whether you're the show creator, the writer, the producer, whether you're Matt, Al Jean, things like that, all the different things that you do, and how Fox is part of airing it on the Sunday, you know, the animation domination block on Sunday nights, how all that part is synchronized, if you will, to make sure that Simpsons remains that top of mind, that legendary status before it becomes, you know, true definition of a legend, which means it has been. I think that's the whole point, is that the fans tell us that I can't get enough of this. I don't know if you had heard, but we recently had an event at Hollywood Highland in Los Angeles where we had a marathon, a Simpsons viewing marathon, and two people won, where it was literally watching all the Simpsons episodes back to back without a break, and the contest was who could last the longest. And we had
how long did that take?
Oh, I can't it long. But
it's really just trying not to fall asleep at that point, isn't it?
Well, that and, you know, the humorous thing is how do you get past the stank? Because you're not showering for that many that much time, and you're right, you're not, you know, you're given breaks, but those breaks are short, far and few in between, because it is a marathon. And you really get the Simpsons diehard fans out there. And you get people watching episodes.
I thought I was a fan. I'm not. I'm out. Yeah.
The entire marathon, the true fans are saying verbatim the dialogue in the show.
Yeah.
They're saying it in real time. That's, you know, you've got Americana in your pocket.
You might have a problem at that point.
Well, they wouldn't think that. They wouldn't think that.
What is the one property that drew you to 20th Century Fox originally?
Well, there's numerous ones, but I think the one that really, I just love the irreverence of both The Simpsons, but in particular, the Family Guy. You know, that is really what Seth MacFarlane does in storytelling on Family Guy in particular. It's just hilarious. You know, Brian and Stewie and all their adventures. Just the dry humor about it is just, it's amazing. It's funny. You can't, it's one of those things you, the best way I'll describe it, it's sort of akin.
Have you not heard? Have you not heard?
The bird is the word.
The bird is the word. Bird, bird, bird. Hilarious. But, you know, the best way I'll describe what drew me to that show and why I love it and I had the good fortune to work on it indirectly is that it's one of those shows that if you turn the video off and just listen to the audio, you're rolling. You're on your ass laughing your head off.
Oh, they'll play clips in the Omaha every now and then of just the audio on the radio in the morning.
And it's hilarious.
They're like, we got to play this.
Yeah, or if you go reverse and you turn the video off and turn the audio off and just watch the video. The way it's done as sight gags is amazing. And, you know, the professional side of me goes, you know, you have a really great, relevant show when you don't have to watch it from beginning to end. You can just flip your remote and get to that section or randomly go on a season like compilation and just watch any particular scene and it's funny. Like, you know, the multiverse episodes, we're going back to the multiverse. It's amazing. All of the parodies it's amazing. And then you got a stellar cast of people that are voicing these characters. Mila Kunis, like, oh my God, that's awesome.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
I think you guys are doing a lot of Fox. Well, we do have to wind the show down.
Sure.
But we want to start with, we're doing a pass the question game.
Oh, fun.
And we actually had two guests on the last show. So we had Melissa Morris Ivone. She's Operation Nice. I'm sure you met her. She's a out person. So her question for you is,
if we can read it.
Yeah, we can
make it up.
What was the worst toy idea that ever came across your desk?
I can't tell you. There's a shitload of them. I'll tell you that. That's the best answer I'll give you. And the reason I'll tell you that is because it was a shitty toy idea that came across my desk. It didn't make it to market. There's no need to talk about it.
Okay.
But you know what? There's a lot. But I will say, not shitty because they just like, oh my God, that's stupid, whoever buy that. It was shitty because I think it was before its time is the best answer I'll give you. Which means it's not shitty like it's dead. It's some vault. It's in a box. It's in some treasure chest that's not going to be revealed for another century.
It's going to be one of those, like, when they're like, how did they cancel the Family Guy twice? You're going to be like, how did this toy not get made 20 years ago?
Yeah. I'd say, you know, just to add to that, if I can give it one official answer, there were concepts for toys that would come across our desk, our group, across Mattel that were made for making its sake that didn't have a reason for being. So I don't know if that makes sense to you guys, but, you know, why would somebody want to fly this toy? Why would somebody want to push this toy? Why would somebody want to do this? Would they really want to collect that? Or was it really because you just felt like doing something, or you've had this in your back pocket for 15 years and you just want to make it happen? So a lot of that stuff, again, I go back to Mattel's a really smart company. They understand, they have a really good understanding of who their audience is and when is the right time to release and reveal a product line.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
And Stefan Muma asks, how do you feel about excessive chest hair?
It's interesting. The aerodynamics suck. I'll give you that. I can't speak to that because, you know, I'm half Asian. It doesn't mean shit to me.
Love it.
Yeah, it's just the drag, the wind resistance, ooh, must be awful. And listen, how cool is it that as an adult with excessive chest hair, you have your own bib?
It's not bad.
It's built in.
You
gotta love it. And kind of a little comforter, too, you know?
Comforter? I mean, there's like, how can you not innovate with your own bib?
You don't have to wear a wool sweater in the winter.
You could literally just, you know how cool it is that you can walk into Home Depot and say, I just want the male side of the Velcro, because I want to put that up in my living room. And you could just buy a trampoline and just go to town. Excessive chest hair is a blessing, actually.
I am coming up with so many toy ideas, and I'm sure these will not be the worst ones. They're just ahead of their time.
They're actually one of the better ones.
Yeah. That's right. Just off of that.
Yeah. There you go. Chest hair toupee is for kids.
All right, and we got to ask you, Luke Micey is our next guest, and also Diana Valentine. So if you have a question for Luke and or Diana.
Yes, I would actually hey, Luke, what do you see?
What do you see?
Well, Luke Micey's, so I want to know what Luke sees. What does he see coming up?
We will find out in a couple weeks. And anything for Diana?
Diana, I hope you had fun at the Red Sox game last night. So why didn't I go with you?
Oh, stood up.
Damn, I hate her. And you know, Dan's a good friend of mine who's a neighbor in Southern California. And the funny thing about her is, ask her why we haven't gotten together for lunch. I see her more often outside of California than I do in our own backyard.
Well, I mean, Steve Gordon here, if we want to have lunch with him here, we got to pay.
Isn't that hilarious?
I'm like, I have to pay to have lunch with Steve?
He's like 2 blocks from our office.
Ridiculous.
Can I have another question for Luke?
Yeah.
Ask him when he went Brokeback camping. Last time he went Brokeback Mountain camping.
We will find out.
Yeah. Wow.
And ask him what his PIN number is.
Did you steal his wallet and you're looking to use the ATM? Is that what the PIN number's for?
Okay. Luke, just say, Luke, what is your PIN number? Can you show me your PIN number?
We're going to have to play him that recording.
Yeah. All right, well, thank
you. You gotta say just like, show me your PIN number.
All right, we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening. Questions, comments, if you want to drop in your PIN number, 36point.com.
Thanks for being on the show, Rick.
Thanks, guys. That was a blast.